The Business on RT Radio 1 with Ulster Bank. For when you're keen to know what Brexit means for your business, visit ulsterbank.ie/Brexit.
Well, another event that was cancelled due to COVID-19 was the Eurovision Song Contest, a competition that's close to the heart of our next guest, the man behind these tunes.
I am the voice of the past that will always be filled with my sorrows, blood in my fields.
We were the rock and roll kids. Rock and roll was all we did. You raised me up.
Brendan Graham started songwriting after being made redundant in his 40s, and it's worked out very well for him, and he joins us now from County Mayo. Brendan, you're in self-isolation there. I know you have five children, five daughters. Are you asking them to stick around and help out?
We've told them all to stay away from us. They're not. They're mostly about around Dublin. There's one in Cork who is a doctor. She's on maternity leave, but she's already offered to go back in and help out. And basically, you know, it'd be nice to see them and see the grandchildren, but, you know, we know what they look like by now, so we can wait a while longer.
Brendan, one of the casualties of the crisis so far has been the Eurovision Song Contest not happening this year. You're very closely associated with, you've had the Irish entry four times, and your song has won it twice.
Yeah, as Oscar Wilde, I think, said, to win it once, or something like this, to win it once was careless and to win it twice was unforgivable. And I know we caused a few alarm bells in RT with regard to hosting it and the thing. But yeah, it's an awful pity. There are people, I always watch it, there are people who are huge fans. I feel my heart goes out particularly to Leslie Roy, who I thought this year had one of the best songs we've had for years. And she must be totally gutted and that at this stage it's cancelled. So, but on the upside, yesterday, The Voice version 2020 was released by Emer Quinn as the single from her new album, Eru. And it's the first recording of it with an orchestra and with the RT Concert Orchestra. So it's quite special and I'm excited about that. And it might give some little bit of lightness and brightness to people who will be disappointed by the Eurovision not being on.
Yeah, I can imagine we could all do with a little bit of lightness and brightness. When you look back at your songwriting career, Brendan, when did you write your first song? Do you remember your first song?
I do, because I still have the check, £1, 1 and 10 pence from Shaftesbury Music in London. I never spent it because I'll tell you what, Richard, I thought if I can't do better than that, I should give up writing. And I also thought that I might never get another one. So I kept it all those years. It's a sort of a salutary reminder of the vagaries of writing music for a living.
You were born in Tipperary, but the family moved around quite a bit.
Yeah, we did. My dad was in the bank. He was first assigned to Nina in Tipperary, in County Tipperary, then from there to Castle Island. And my dad there got reconnected with rugby because he was a good friend of Mick Doyle Sr. Mick Doyle, who was the Irish coach years ago. Well, his dad and my dad sort of reinvigorated the Castle Island rugby team, one of whose star players was the late, great Con Houlihan. And it's not a rural myth because I saw it myself that Con lined out in his socks to play for Castle Island because at the time they didn't make boots big enough for mighty men like Con.
So he played in his socks?
He played in his socks and I actually saw it. And then I had another great connection with Con because the school in Castle Island was all through Oscuilge and I had come from an English-speaking school. So, and I was very bad at maths. So my dad sent me to Con for grinds at maths. And sure, I loved going down to Con. He'd talk to you about everything under the sun, bar mats, and, you know, about how to tickle trout in streams and how to pick blackberries and all this, when to get them. But he said to me once, because I had said to him, oh, Con, you know, I really hate these mats and I'm not going to make any fist of it. And he said to me, in only the way that Con Hoolan could, Ara, don't worry, boy. All you need for mats is a form of sly cunning. Literature is the thing. And I've never forgotten that. Like, so he was an influencer before social influencing came around.
Did you keep in contact with him, Brendan, over the years?
I did. He ended up coming to Dublin and writing for various papers, and from time to time he'd put a little fogra at the bottom of his column if something good happened to me about an old pupil in Castle Island. And then I went to England and I went to Australia, so I kind of lost contact with him. And about 8 years ago, I wrote a letter to him, just recalling that time and the piece of wisdom that he had gifted me with that I never forgot. Last year, his longtime partner, Harriet Duffin, wrote me a beautiful long letter saying how she had received my letter to Con the day before he died, and she read it to him, and he seemed pleased that I'd written and that I'd remembered. And the next day again, when she came in, he said to her, would you read that letter again from Brendan? And she did, and they were his last words. So sometimes there's powers and forces that we don't fully understand at work. And I was so glad that the inspiration he had gifted to me way back then in some way had come around full circle and perhaps given him a moment of pleasure in his final hours.
And when it comes to inspiration, where do you get your inspiration for songs from? Is it a place, a particular place you go to? Is it something you see? Is it, what is it?
Some of the inspiration comes from, as San Mikan used to say, which comes first, the words or the music? And his answer, when people would ask him that, his answer was, it's neither, it's the phone call. So sometimes it's the phone call when somebody says, we need a song for a particular event, like the birth of Prince George, we need a lullaby. So that is sort of appeals to the directly professional side of you as a professional songwriter. Other things can be, I mean, the song The Voice came to me from walking in the Wicklow Mountains, and I could hear the wind in the trees, and it seemed to me to be a voice. So that's where the inspiration of that song came from. Rock and Roll Kids, I was at a Fats Domino concert way back in the old boxing stadium in Dublin, and Fats was bumping and grinding his piano and rocking away, and towards the end of the evening, all these people who had come from their day jobs in suits and ties got up and loosened them and started sort of bopping away, and it struck me, underneath the suits and the ties, these are all Rock and Roll Kids. So I borrowed a pen from a Coopers and Lybrand type person beside me. It was a very fancy pen, and just scribbled down the title, Rock and Roll Kids.
Did you give it back to him?
I did indeed. I'd never see anyone from the financial area, from the business world, left short of a pen. So it's anywhere and everywhere. Sometimes if somebody sends me a piece of music, I just listen to try and get into the heart of the music. I might listen a couple of hundred times and then something emerges.
You listen a couple of hundred times?
I would. Yeah, I would. And then when I have the song finished, I'd probably play it a couple of hundred times before I'd go out and get it demoed. And sometimes, like with, say, You Raise Me Up, I had the song written. I was happy with the last line I had. It was good, but it wasn't great. And then eventually one day I was just trying dishes, I think, and I got the line, You Raise Me Up to More Than I Can Be, which to me was the line that had been elusive, evading me.
You Raise Me Up has been an extraordinary phenomenon. I think it has been played on American radio over a million times. It's been translated into, I don't know, 40 languages, and there are about 1,000 different recordings. Are you very proud of the song, and do you ever hear it in unusual places if you're out around the world?
I hear it in every place, and people must be sick to the teeth of hearing it, you know, and I'm happy.
Going back to that first royalties check you got for the first song, I presume You Raise Me Up Now and the royalty stakes has probably been a lot higher than that. How much have you made from it?
Now, Richard, I know this is a business program, and you know one of the first tenets of business is keep your cards close to your chest sometimes. I've done well out of it, I have to say. Roughly, how well? My pension song.
€1 million? Are you talking about €3 million? Are you talking about...
Well, it could be any of those. You know. I know your job is to ask questions and my job is to dodge as many of them as I can.
Well, look, you're obviously very proud of the song and you're delighted with its commercial success. I suppose I'd put it that way, would I?
Well, I am, but I'm also delighted with the other path it has gone, which is totally non-commercial. And it has been used as theme songs for the reopening of the National Civil Rights Museum in America. It's the theme song for the elite cancer care centre in Australia.
And the idea that you write a song and it goes out there and to some extent you have to let it go, even if in a sense you still own the rights to it. Are there circumstances where you'd say no, you know, to the use of the song? I wouldn't allow it for that. What might they be?
Well, I've written into my contract with the publishers that I won't be allow it to be used for the promotion of alcohol. I won't allow it to be used in any situation where it might promote any sort of violence or militaristic thing. And I've turned down. There was a very militaristic video made a number of years ago in the US to do with tanks and guns and everything. And without permission, they used You Raise Me Up. So we got that taken down.
When you look at your career as a songwriter, you wrote your first song, you were saying, and you got the small royalties check from it. But at what point did you feel that this is what I'm going to do for a living? What brought that about?
Redundancy. Redundancy, yeah. I'm basically a songwriter or a full-time songwriter by default. I was always tipping away at songs at night and at the weekend, but, you know, with families and mortgages and all of that, it would have been a very unsettling type of career to follow because you never know when something is going to happen. So in 1993, I was an industrial engineer in the clothing industry, and the industry went through a bad time and I was out of a job at the age of 48. I literally became a full-time songwriter, as I say, by default. And I also learned an important lesson. I mean, it was very scary being out of work. And the scariest part was having nowhere to go of a morning. So I used to go in and sit on Paddy Kavanagh's bench on the canal, maybe hoping some of his inspiration and creativity would rub off on me. But it was a place to go and I'd bring my jotter and pen with me and be scribbling away. And then fortunately, the following year, 1994, Rock and Roll Kids came up at the Eurovision. So I began to earn from what I really loved to do. And then the Voice 2 years later in 1996 with Emer, everything didn't work out. I had a song supposedly in the sort of cult movie California with Brad Pitt. They had told me the scene in a delicatessen where he goes in, presses the jukebox to play a song for Juliette Lewis, I think was his co-star, who worked in the deli. And it was a song I had written and all of that. And then the director's cut 15 minutes out of the movie and the song was gone. So as a songwriter friend in Nashville says to me, you ain't in the movie, Brendan, until you're sitting in there eating the popcorn and hearing it. So you learn, you get the bounces up and down. So you just get up and get on with it, you know.
When you look at the music industry now and writing songs and people trying to make a living from doing that, there seems to be, if you're really good at specialist areas, maybe you can do okay. And then obviously a lot of the really big hits can be quite formulaic. There's a formula to writing, you know, maybe a hit pop song. Do you think it's a tougher place for songwriters now?
I think if you're solely a songwriter, as I am, that, you know, doesn't sing and doesn't perform and doesn't produce, it definitely is tougher because singers want to be writers as well. And you also now get these teams of writers. So you look at the credits and songs now and it's 4, 5, 6 writers and they're, you know, they're producers and they're people and, you know, drum machines and all of that. So it's harder for an outside writer to break in for that reason and for economic reasons, because obviously if the singer writes the song, then he and his management and companies have 2 streams of income. The industry has changed. I think there's also less recognition for creative artists. You know, the whole thing about the European directive on copyright, about fair remuneration for the people who create the work, and sort of filling the value gap between what we earn and what the internet providers and the platforms earn.
The platforms, the internet providers, I presume many of your songs are up there on digital platforms. Do you get proper royalties and get paid for that?
The answer is a firm no. Now, obviously, some of the platforms are licensed and regulated and have been brought kicking and screaming to the table. But, for example, I have something like roughly 2 billion views of my songs, mainly You Raise Me Up, on some of the internet platforms, on YouTube, for example. On about half of those views, I'm not even credited. We're looking for fair play. We're not looking for big slices of the action. But, you know, a number of years ago, I had in one quarter 11 million views on some of these platforms in America alone. And the royalty I got was, I think, $200 and something. Now, okay, my co-writer would get the same. But all those views, people can hold on to those. So there's no incentive to go and buy, you know, either download it legally or at the time buy a CD or a record, which I know has changed. So it is cutting off sources of our income. So I hope when it comes to our government in implementing the recent European directive, which just was trying to guarantee fair play, I hope the government will do it. And I know the tech companies are important and they give employment and so on, but, you know, they do have a moral responsibility to, you know, pay the people who create the work. Because if I look at one of my songs, say, in any foreign language in a foreign country, and I look at it on YouTube or one of the platforms, there'll be an ad in front of it. And I'm fine with that. And if the thing has been monetized, I'm fine with that. I know the tech companies and everybody has to make their few shillings out of it. But I'm also saying we, without us, the creators, there wouldn't be that there. And all we're looking for is, you know, a fair play in this situation.
Songwriter Brendan Graham, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
You're very welcome. Thanks indeed, Richard.